Hello and welcome to episode 20 of Engaging Internal Comms. This is the podcast for employee engagers and internal communicators who like to keep up to date with all that is new in our profession. My name's Craig Smith from The Big Picture People. If you've not already listened to the previous 19 episodes of the show, I thoroughly recommend it. We've got some amazing interviews with some amazing people on our website, which is engagingic.com, but also you can pick them up via iTunes, Spotify, whatever is your podcast platform of choice. Next week, we have Vlad Ledvitsky from Engage for Success. He's going to be telling us all about how we can use volunteers and volunteering within our organizations to improve employee engagement, which I think is a really interesting angle. And we had a great conversation with Vlad when we recorded the interview, which we've already got recorded. So if you've not already been across to our website, which is engagingic.com, you can go across there. You can sign up to our mailing list. And we'd really like to get some feedback from you. As I keep mentioning in episodes, we are getting towards the end of season one, which eventually we will get there. But the issue that I've got is I've got so many amazing people who are approaching me wanting to be interviewed or responding to my requests to see if they want to be interviewed. I just can't stop. So it's a nice dilemma to have. And as long as the great interviewees keep coming along, and I'm going to keep interviewing them. And so we're going to keep the first series running, but we are looking for ideas for the second series. We actually, on our Facebook group, we have a survey running, a SurveyMonkey survey, just to see what our listeners are listening to, what they like about the show, what they'd like to hear more of, any format ideas they have for the second series. So we're going to give ourselves a little bit of time to think about that before we dive in. So we have a Facebook group, which is Engaging IC, and also you can find that link via the website as well. And we also have a private Facebook group, which if you'd like to join that, you can click on the link there and request to join, and we'll let you in. If you haven't already done so, please do subscribe to the show on your podcast platform. I know I say it every week, but it's really important. It really helps us boost our visibility and helps us to get more people involved and listening to the show. And finally, I know I mentioned earlier that we are going to keep the first series running as long as we've got this great flow of interviewees. If you are interested in being interviewed on the show and you think you've got something you'd like to tell our listeners about, I'd be really more than interested to hear from you. So why don't you go across to engagingic.com, leave me a little comment, let me know who you are via the chat box there on the bottom of the page, and just let me know what it is you'd like to talk about and what your big idea is or what your theme is. And I'd be really keen to hear from you. More than interested to sort of hear what ideas. We've had quite a few people approach me and ask to be on the show. I am a little bit selective. I mean, I don't want anyone who's just coming along just to kind of sell themselves. I want to be able to add value and ideas to the audience. So please bear that in mind if you are thinking of being an interviewee. Anyway, that's enough of this introduction. On to today's interview. So just imagine that your internal comms role requires that you have to communicate to 600 journalists in an organization that is renowned for the quality and accuracy of its reporting and journalism. Today's interviewee is going to tell us all about the challenges and opportunities that that role brings, and how the importance of understanding the requirements and needs of that audience and being very empathetic to their needs is a key part of her internal communication role. I think there's going to be some transferable lessons and learnings for all of us, for any of us who communicate, whether it's 600 journalists or whether it's an internal audience who, particularly in the time of the pandemic, have very specific requirements that we need to be sensitive to, but also have different things that they need to listen and respond to within our communications in order to get them to engage with it. So I think this is going to be an interview that you're going to find a really interesting one. I certainly found it a fascinating insight into an organization that I've respected and known for a number of years. So my interviewee today is Megan Dold. Megan is head of comms for UK EMEA at the Financial Times. Megan's been with the Financial Times for 5 years now, mainly working internal comms and in corporate communications and corporate social responsibility roles. Prior to that, Megan worked at organizations such as Thomson Reuters Foundation and the UN Foundation. Hello, Megan. How are you?
Hi, I'm good. Thanks for having me.
It's an absolute pleasure. Megan, remind me where you're based, please.
I'm based in London.
You're down in London, yes, and obviously that's not a broad London accent that we're hearing there. Where are you from originally?
I'm originally from Chicago, in the States. I've been in the UK for about 10 years though, so it's been a while.
Fantastic. Well, sometimes on my episodes, I have to explain who a little bit or give a little bit of background to the organization that my interviewee works for. But the FT, the Financial Times, I think is probably a fairly ubiquitous organization. But tell us a little bit, some things about the Financial Times that maybe aren't generally known, or just give us a sense of how large an organization it is and what your coverage is as an organization.
Sure. So we're a global news organization. We've been around for over 130 years. Most people know that we provide news, but we also provide services primarily to a business-oriented audience. So we're based in London, which is obviously where I'm based, but we do have about 2,600 employees around the world. Most of them are in our regional offices, which is in New York, Hong Kong, Sofia, and Manila. And the rest are in bureaus or commercial offices around the world. So our sort of internal structure is primarily editorial. As you can imagine, we have about 600 journalists, mm-hmm. As well as product and technology. We have about 400 people working on our product team, and then the commercial team. And the rest is, you know, some, by and large, sort of support staff, our B2B services, which sells subscriptions to companies, and so forth, including communications team, which is what I'm on.
Excellent. Oh, superb. That's thank you very much. That's a really, really helpful background. And when we spoke originally, we had a preliminary conversation. We talked about the fact that you work in an organization with and your target audience is 600 journalists, and that's quite a discerning audience to communicate to. So I'd be really interested to know how, you know, what some of the challenges that brings for you as communicating to people who communicate for a living or job as a very core role within it to communicate. So could you just give us a flavor for how what challenges that brings and how you go about doing that?
Yeah, I mean, it definitely keeps things interesting. I think, you know, sort of the rule number one of any internal comms job is to just know your stakeholders and adapt your style, you know, for different audiences when possible. Yeah. So I think when it comes to journalists, you know, any PR person will know that they have no time. You know, they're incredibly time-poor individuals. They have crazy deadlines. So it's pretty understandable that they can't be as engaged as other departments might be in some of the internal initiatives we do. And, you know, I approach that knowing that. And so I try to be honest to the point and really explain to them, you know, why they should care about something. Mm. I mean, I once had one of our bureau chiefs tell me, well, you're not really what I expected from a comms person, which I actually took as a big compliment, because I think he was expecting me to be not as sort of in tune with what they need and how they need to be given information, which is very quick, very direct, you know, should I care about this or not? And yeah. I think if you start from that approach, you're much more likely to be successful.
Yeah, it's interesting because I've worked in organizations where, and I'm not sure whether this is similar to what we're talking about here, but where there's a people who have a very strong professional identity, which isn't always, you know, that their association is more with their profession or sways more towards their profession than it does to the organization in particular. Examples I often use are, if any of you've ever worked with anyone in the medical profession, they often have a, you know, they're first and foremost a medical person, and they happen to work for the hospital or the trust that they're associated with. And I'm not sure whether is that similar with journalists. The journalists tend to have that sort of loyalty, professional loyalty ahead of anything else. And you've got to really kind of understand that and engage with that in order to get your messages across to them.
Yeah. I mean, I think journalists care a lot about their personal brand, which is, you know, completely understandable. At the same time, I think, you know, the FT is a really strong brand in itself. And, you know, I think people are really, really proud to work for the FT. You know, it's not, the media profession isn't doing great these days. And I think the FT is one of sort of the stars that has been able to overcome, you know, the perils of Facebook and Google when it comes to advertising. We've really figured out how to keep our subscriptions going. And, you know, I think journalists are really proud to work for the FT. At the same time, they do care about their personal brand. And again, as a communicator, if I can, I will explain to them why something might be good for their personal brand. Because, you know, these people have incredible profiles on Twitter. Their reach is more so than definitely mine, but also anyone else, I would say, you know, who's not an editorial. I mean, that's just what they do, right? But they also know that their allegiance is to the FT. So it is a little bit of a balance. And, you know, I think in these days, it's pretty normal, I think, for journalists, but also other people to really have these sort of strong personal brands that they really want to cultivate. Yeah. And if you can help them do that while also, you know, sort of creating engagement for your company and for your company brand, that's not a bad thing.
Yeah, it's a win-win. It's again, another analog is working with, I've done quite a bit of work in higher education and sort of higher end academics. Again, it's very similar to what you've just been saying. They have a, you know, their own sort of reputation within their research field, within their specialism. But again, tying that to the institution and finding a win-win in there, in your comms for them, I think is a really important tool to use and a really important way of getting them to engage with some of those more kind of corporate messages, as it were, I guess. Anything else that you do then? There's obviously a strong element there of shaping your messages about really kind of being empathetic to what they need and being able to kind of fit those more than two elements, but any elements of what you're trying to communicate across them. Anything else that you do in terms of adapting your practice, given the discerning nature, as it were?
I mean, this is an obvious one, but, you know, I am rigorous about checking my emails 300 times before it goes to a journalist, because I think, you know, poorly written comms and even typos can actually have a really damaging effect on how people perceive you, especially when you're dealing with journalists. I mean, yeah. You know, I think it's so important. And this applies to anyone who's pitching journalists, not just, you know, speaking to them internally, but your own communications has to be gold standard. That's what they expect. And that's what they deserve. I mean, their livelihoods are based on their writing, you know, and being able to write persuasively. And so I'm not a journalist, right? So, but I will do whatever I can to make sure that my communications and my writing is at least, you know, trying to get to their standard, and is rigorously checked and fact-based before it goes out.
Yeah, no, that's a really, really good point. So one of the things that we talked about, just extending that this conversation on this point a little bit further, is you'd said to me, and I'll kind of quote this, that you said you'd working in an environment where internal comms does not exist. So that's going to kind of immediately raise the ears of the audience listening to this. So just expand on that a little bit and why you think that is the case within the environment that you're working in at the moment.
Yeah, I mean, I actually think that applies to most companies these days. You know, especially now, transparency is just so important. And, you know, I actually think that bringing internal and external comps together rather than thinking of them as separate things can really work in your favor. Now, I'm pretty lucky in that I'm not in the HR, you know, I work very closely with our HR team, but I'm not in HR. I know a lot of internal comms functions could be based in HR. I do internal and corporate. And I think that really helps me prepare for situations where, as you said, internal comms doesn't exist, i.e. there are leaks or things get out. But I actually think that this can be a really powerful thing. You know, I see FT employees as our best champions. You know, we want people to know that the FT is a really diverse, vibrant, and inclusive workplace. And that's not actually what most people think of the FT. And we've been trying to change our perception for a long time. And, you know, the best way to do that is to show it through your own people. So to me, you know, using your employees as sort of your employer brand champions, and, you know, getting things out that might just go internally can be a really, really good thing. I also think that customers these days, and in our, you know, for the FT, that's readers, really want their companies that they support or buy from to reflect their values. And, you know, using your own people as champions is one way to get that across. So, I'm really happy for people to talk about, you know, I'll just give one example. When we went into lockdown in March, we were very, very transparent and honest about the measures we'd have to take, you know, and how working from home was going to be hard for people. And a new person who joined the company working in technology immediately went on Twitter and just said, wow, I can't believe I'm hearing this from the CEO. He's being incredibly honest. That was a great thing for us. I mean, you know, you can't get honesty, and that's the best way to show people what we're all about. I mean, I can write, you know, a press release or a blog, but the easiest way, I think, and the most transparent way to talk about what your company is like is through your own people. I mean, I'll talk briefly, but obviously leaks happen. And, you know, working at a media organization, you know, this happens. They're not always welcome, but I think we are always prepared for it. So if we know something's going to get out, and all, you know, like the gender pay gap, which a few years ago all UK companies had to report, it was a big deal. And you know, we worked really hard to make sure that we briefed our journalists beforehand and ensure that they had first dibs on the story, because it is a story. Even our own gender pay gap is a story. And I think if you approach it like that, you can control the story a little bit better than just assuming, well, this won't get out. Of course it got out. And yeah, that's okay, as long as you're 100% prepared for that, you know, and you're transparent and you equip people with the right messages, and just don't lie.
Yeah. No, I think that's a really, really interesting point. It takes me right back to the very first episode of this podcast that I remember I had an interview with Rafa Hennigan, who was from AO.com. Now, completely different business to yours, obviously completely different market. They're a retailer, electrical retailer. But we were talking there about very much around, you know, the importance of matching your external brand values with your internal brand values, and that any lack of congruence there is immediately found out. I think we've all probably come across organizations that we've interacted with, not necessarily from a services perspective, but maybe from as a consumer, where they have an espoused way of doing things, and actually when you dig beneath below the surface, it's actually very different, and it's not exactly what they portrayed themselves as. And I think, you know, I think it's really important. I really like that sort of story there, though, about the fact that, you know, you're it's always when I see the BBC, you know, reporting on themselves, I always think, I wonder how difficult that is for them internally to be able to, you know, report on, you know, the latest director general has been kind of fired or whatever. And obviously what you've been talking about there is that you've made that internal story part of the story that you're allowing your journalists to just, you know, communicate as if it was an external story. So I think that's a really, really, really interesting way of reflecting your values.
Yeah.
Yeah. Sorry, go on. Yeah.
Oh no, I was just going to say that we build it into our plans. And in some ways it's really lucky that we have, you know, I mean, I would argue the FT is one of the best, you know, sort of media companies in the world. And it's great that we have access to these journalists. I'm sure a lot of other communicators would love to have access to an FT journalist. And
yeah,
it is actually, I think, incredibly beneficial most of the time. So, you know, it's just important to build that into your plans. And you know, journalists always want to have the story first, right? So if someone else didn't have it, we would just be burning our own internal bridges. And there's just no point in doing that. So I think we are very considerate, and we're very careful about making sure that our own people know what's happening first.
Yeah. Yeah, excellent. One of the things we talked about as well in the preliminary interview was that the fact that you are looking to reduce the amount of communication channels that you're using at the moment, and you said that you, as far as you're aware, you're the first organization who's going to drop Workplace as a platform. And I know a lot of our listeners will be either looking at using Workplace, maybe using Workplace, and again, I mean, maybe not just Workplace, but other platforms like that. I think it'd be really interesting, and you said you're happy to talk about this, to find out what was the rationale behind that. I mean, maybe what led you to use it in the first place, then, and now what has drawn you to the conclusion that you're not going to be using it, and what are you going to be using as a substitute, if anything at all? So if you don't mind, I think that would be a really interesting topic to just explore with you.
Yeah, of course. I will say right away that, you know, I think Workplace is a great product. It just wasn't right for us. It wasn't the right fit for us. We actually were one of the early users of Workplace. So we were a beta user, I think back in, I want to say 2016, back when it was called Facebook at Work.
You might be just worthwhile just for people who aren't familiar with Workplace, just to tell us a little bit actually what Workplace is, because I know what it is, but I'm assuming everybody else does, which obviously isn't fair maybe. So if you, yeah, so Facebook Workplace, what is it, just as a sort of a little bit of a sort of a pretext to what the answering the questions that I'd already asked you.
Yeah, of course. It's basically Facebook's solution for businesses when it comes to, it's a social collaborative platform that's restricted to your business. So it's not, you know, I think this was one of the issues we had, was just that when it was called Facebook at Work, some people felt a little bit uneasy about that, because, you know, Facebook has been going through some, you know, tough times, I think, when it comes to perceptions. And so that didn't actually help. And, I think, funny enough, if it had been called Workplace at the beginning, it might have been a bit easier for us to implement it. Because Workplace is a fantastic product. And, you know, now, I mean, we dropped it a few years ago because we just felt like it wasn't, I mean, our journalists weren't really using it, but that's not surprising. You know, as I mentioned before, they're less likely to engage in the first place. And that's, you know, we accept that. It didn't feel like what we needed. What we actually needed was a boring intranet where people could find resources really easily. And that's what people asked us, and we actually didn't give them that. And so it's actually the fault is on us for not identifying the right product. So we dropped Workplace, and we are now looking for an intranet that sort of works with G Suite. So we've been speaking to a few suppliers, so that we have something where people can actually go and easily find things that they need. And, you know, I think, there's no one size fits all solution, but especially in a remote working environment, we talk a lot about, you've, you know, probably heard about asynchronous working, which seems to be the buzzword now. And we actually, you know, we have Google, so we have G Suite, so we have Google Docs. We use those things. We use Slack as well, you know, just to keep people in touch with each other for sort of brief updates, but Slack isn't an intranet. And so I think what, you know, what we need at least as sort of a minimum viable product, if you will, is an intranet and Slack. And I think those two could work really, really well together. And so that's what I'm trying to figure out now is what does our intranet look like? Because we do need somewhere to, you know, if we're going to do our onboarding from now on is going to be entirely virtual. You know, Slack could probably be used for onboarding, but I think we need a place where we can host videos and that kind of content that can live for longer than it does in an email or on Slack.
Yeah. I agree. I mean, I know exactly what you mean. I think from it as an external perspective, I do hear this quite a lot is that I think there's a concept in training and development, which is called called self-hugging, which is you kind of tend to develop things or you write programs in a way that you would like to be a participant in yourself. And I think sometimes there's a danger with internal comms is that, you know, if we like a particular way of communicating or with socially with our friends or whatever, that will naturally adopt into a workplace. And as you say, it's not always the case, is it? Whereas, you know, the idea that you can create a platform a little bit like Facebook where everybody kind of posts things and comments and everybody knows what's happening. But if what they need is a sort of a repository of information and somewhere where they can go and get stuff or where you can host an onboarding program, then I think that's obviously, you know, Facebook probably isn't the best platform for that. And I always think Slack, I like Slack, but I use it more as a project management tool. I think it, as a communication tool, it can be a bit frustrating sometimes because I find with my team, sometimes we lose, although it does the threads, you sometimes just lose the thread, as it were, of a conversation and something gets missed. And we end up having to use Google Forms and Google Sheets just as a kind of project tracking plan. But it's a good instant messaging tool and it's a good way of organizing those instant messages, I think. But I think finding that platform that works for everybody and actually satisfies the core requirements, I think is really important there.
And I don't think there is a platform that works for everyone, you know, and I think this is an issue that I don't think we're unique with this. I mean, we definitely have different subcultures in the FT. Our editorial team works very differently. Their ways of working are just very different from our product and technology team. I think, you know, something like Workplace, I think it might work really well in a different kind of culture, or sort of a more homogeneous culture where you have people, let's say everyone's on the front line and, you know, they only have their phones. I think in those kind of situations, Workplace would be a great tool. You know, and I, to your point on Slack, I completely agree. I think, I think Slack can also be very overwhelming. In fact, I've had to mute channels because I was just bombarded with updates. And so I think the beauty of an intranet, which, you know, intranets themselves are, I don't think anyone loves intranets. They've never been a loved thing. You know, it's never been something that you say, wow, I've never heard anyone say, I have a great intranet.
Yeah.
Ever.
Yeah.
And I mean, but I do think that now we do need it, you know? And so at the moment we have a Google site, which is not enough. And it maybe was enough when we were in the office, but it's certainly not enough now that we're working from home and that we probably will work from home for the foreseeable future. So this is just, you know, the considerations have changed. And, you know, I'm sure the sort of internet business is probably doing really well right now because everyone realizes that they need something to host information, you know? And I think back to your earlier point about, well, comms people, you know, we we tend to have more information than anyone else. But so it's a mistake to think that just because I know where I can find something doesn't mean that everyone else knows, because I'm the one who put it there. I think it's a fallacy of comms. Like, if it's really hard to search for something, then no one's going to find it.
Exactly. I do think we run the risk of sometimes being like plumbers who live in leaky houses, is that we've got all of the, you know, we think everybody else knows where this stuff is, but actually we don't. And sometimes we're not the best communicators ourselves internally amongst our own teams. That's what I find anyway. But no, I think that's a really interesting point that you've raised there, about, you know, the sort of the use of these different channels and finding the appropriate one. And I think from the intranet perspective, I've got good friends who run intranet businesses, and I think you're right. I think sometimes it's a bit like the corporate teletext. You know, we've got that sort of vision of I remember some of the early intranets I was not part of, but remember I used to use, that were very, you know, when you compared them with a kind of an external website, they left a lot to be desired. It was like really old code, and it was really blocky and slow and really poorly organized, and you couldn't find anything that you needed. But I think they've moved on significantly since then. And as you say, I think in the current climate, they've definitely, I know that for a fact there's a lot of innovation going on in that space as well. So yeah, One thing we talked about as well, and probably a final point to cover with you, is we'd have a really interesting conversation before the interview, and you were telling me about someone in your organization who you've kind of seconded into a different part of the organization during the pandemic, and you've used this as an opportunity, really, just to, again, coming back to what we were talking about earlier, about really, you know, walking in the shoes of the recipients of your communications, really having that empathy with them. I think that's a really interesting story. Would you mind sharing that with our listeners?
Yeah, of course. So early on, one of the things that we did as a company to survive was to take advantage of secondments. And so we seconded people to other teams that were the ones kind of responsible for building revenue. So I seconded someone from my comms team to work in our B2B subscriptions team. And it was incredibly useful exercise, obviously great for the business, but also because he saw firsthand how little time our colleagues have to digest the stuff that we were producing as comms people. You know, and I think it is so easy to forget as an internal comms person, especially when you're, you know, in the thick of writing these really long, thoughtful business updates or planning these really important internal events around diversity, inclusion, or whatnot, that people might not have time to read it or attend. And it's not because they don't want to, but they have their own day jobs and priorities and objectives and KPIs and things that comms people actually, I think, have. It's just different for us, isn't it? It's really hard. Yeah. I mean, this is a different topic in terms of, it's really hard to measure the effectiveness of comms. And I think, you know, I forget that sometimes. And I forget that, you know, most of the people in the business have really strong KPIs that they're working against. And so they might not be able to go to that event, even if it's really important. And I think it's just good to be aware of that and, you know, definitely not take it personally, but also think about ways that you can overcome that. So, you know, I think if we want someone to read something, you know, it has to come from the top. You know, it has to, we send out a monthly CEO update, and I know it's very, very well read and very, very well received. And it's, people expect that on the first of the month. You know, if you're doing an event, make it 30 minutes and not an hour. I mean, that's such a small thing, but I think, especially if you're doing virtual events, I try to keep them to 30 or 45 minutes to build in, especially to build in comfort breaks for people, because a lot of our colleagues, especially in the FT, are in back-to-back meetings now, and they literally don't have time to even go to the bathroom. And so I think they're not going to want to go to an event, you know, no matter how important it is, if it's run by, you know, about the business. So I try to make events really short and to the point, so that people have time to do them and there's an incentive. And, you know, I think it's just about finding ways to help your colleagues make time for something if it's really that important, and to be understanding that, you know, they might not have time for it because they're doing their own thing, and that's okay.
Yeah. Were these were some of the insights that your colleague who'd been seconded came back to you with, were they? And how did that actually work? So what was the secondment? How long were they there for?
Yeah.
And were they just shadowing your audience, or were they sort of, how did that work?
He was fully in a secondment for 3 months. And actually it worked well both ways, because the team asked him a lot of questions about what it's like to work in comms, and they had no idea about the stuff that we do. So, yeah. I mean, it was just, you know, I think this goes, this is a bigger point about how do you, you know, find ways in a company to over, to sort of foster collaboration and break down silos, you know, especially between departments. And I think secondments are an incredible tool for that because you really, I mean, he was full-time in the team, but we would check in every couple of weeks and he would brief me about, you know, wow, they had no idea that we did A, B, and C, you know? And so not only does it also raise, I think, respect for what communications people do, it helps us understand who we're communicating to. So it was, it, for me, it was a win-win on all levels. And it was just a really interesting thing that I'm actually hoping to do it, myself with another team just to, you know, get that firsthand experience if I can, even if it's for a week or two.
Yeah, I totally agree. I think it's one of the most powerful things you can do. We worked with a theater company a few years ago, and they had a policy, an HR policy it was, and every year you had to spend 3 days, just 3 days, three single days, in a kind of job shadowing secondment role. So it was 3 single days, and you had to pick 3 different teams or departments that you would go and spend some time with. So, you know, for example, if you worked on the ticket desk, you would maybe go and spend a day working with the guys who did the sound, you know, and the electrics behind the stage. You'd maybe go and spend a day with the people who kind of got the theater ready for the shows in the evening, that sort of thing. And it was just a really nice way that everybody kind of respected and understood what everybody did and didn't, it wasn't that, you know, what I did was more important than what you do. It's just different. And it adds, you know, we're all contributing to the same thing at the end of the day. And I thought it was really nice. And it seemed to work really well. Everybody we spoke to really valued it. It wasn't like, oh God, I've got to do my secondment thing again. Everybody really look forward to it. They planned it out at the beginning of the year. And I think it's a really, really powerful, powerful thing to do and definitely to be encouraged.
And it's a great way to keep people. I mean, it's a, you know, you think about, career growth and it, you know, especially these days, it might be hard for you to create new sort of senior opportunities if they're just not available, but things like secondments are great horizontal development opportunities, you know? And I think, it's important. I think that we as comms people also help, you know, our colleagues see that as a growth opportunity. You know, you don't have to sort of go up the ladder. You can move laterally, and gain skills that you wouldn't have otherwise had the time to do. And then you can move on if you want to leave, but at least, you know, they're encouraged to stay for a bit longer. So it's just one of those initiatives, I think, that, really hits a lot of the sweet spots when it comes to, you know, retaining your people and keeping morale high.
Yeah, definitely. I totally agree. So just summarizing then what we've been talking about, the theme of communicating with audiences who are discerning, difficult to get to, you know, quite demanding in certain ways. What would you, if we've got anyone listening to this show, and I guess everybody, every internal communicator to a certain extent, their audience has, you know, specific requirements and specific nuances and things that they need. But what would your tips be if anyone out there is working in an organization where they've got a group of people, either through the way they work, the times they work, their own particular requirements and demands, what would you recommend to them in terms of making sure that your messages are empathetic and get through to the, you know, communicate the points that you want to get through to them and actually listen to or absorbed?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's, if you can, you know, take the time to know, you know, what they care about and what they're going through. I think when it, you know, for journalists, if they're working on a big story, you know, be mindful of that. You know, they might be a little, not as engaged with something, but probably because they've been working nonstop on something else. So I think it's just to be aware of the different projects and strains, you know, and stresses that, people are going through right now, and try to just be a little bit empathetic to that. And, you know, if you can help them in any way, or at least say, hey, by the way, do you know, we have these resources on mental health, going back to the earlier point about, they might not know that. A lot of people don't know, you know, the companies offer a slew of resources, especially around mental health and, different kinds of, you know, well-being, that employees, you know, might not know about. So, and actually I really try to get those out very regularly, because I think that is one thing that we can do better is, you know, remind people where those resources are. But, you know, I think if you can also just, you know, make time, if someone's, you know, snipping at you on email, find out what's going on. If, you know, if you have that kind of relationship, just have a 20-minute virtual coffee with them, just to really understand that something might be happening. It probably has nothing to do with you, and you know, just to move on. And these things are harder to do, I think, now that we're, you know, working virtually. I think, especially journalists, it is much easier to approach them in person. That's just, at least at the FT, that I think that's pretty much the case. But there are other ways to do it. So I think, you know, really take the time to understand what's going on, you know, before you send something out and ask people to do something. Is there a big deadline looming over that department or that team that might affect how they respond to your communications? I think that is a really thing, an important thing to just bear in mind. And, you know, if not take things personally, if someone says, I don't have time to do this, or I don't have time to do this event. You know, because a lot of people are scheduling events. I'm very careful not to schedule sort of our company-wide events at the same time as, you know, a big department event, because then that creates sort of anxiety in a person as well. Which one should I go to? So it is really important to make sure you're, you know, speaking to all the different EAs in the different teams, and that you have sort of a pulse on where these people's time is being pulled, and just be a little bit mindful of that.
Yeah. No, I think that's a useful reminder and a lesson, I think, for many of us. And I think that whole kind of empathetic element. And I guess at the same time, not subordinating your needs. You have a message that you need to communicate to them. It's about finding the best time to do that for them. It's not about sort of saying, okay, well, you know, what I'm trying to do is secondary importance here. But it's about being understanding and having that empathy, I guess, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And find allies who can help you get your message out. You know, it's not, I think internal comms people try to do everything. You know, it's like we have the world on our shoulders, and, you know, there are other people in the company who can help you. And that, you know, people in certain departments might respond better to something that comes from someone else, if it's from their, you know, their team leader or from someone who's respected in that department. Like, it doesn't have to be you. And I think finding allies is just incredibly important.
Yeah, I think any walk of every corporate life, I think, is important, isn't it? Yeah. Fantastic. Well, that's been really helpful, Megan. I did forewarn you as part of the preparation for this that I normally ask people at the end of an interview about something that even people who know them quite well and maybe worked with them for a few years or known them for a few years don't know about them. What is your little secret that you're willing to share with the audience about Megan?
It's not so much a secret, but I mean, it is kind of funny. I'm the only sort of PR flack in a family of retired and former journalists. Like, everyone in my family used to be a journalist. So I think it that probably has something to do with, you know, my ability to get them, at least most of the time. I think I finally have shown them that PR, you know, and communications can be sort of a respected field.
Okay. So I guess that's probably why you've got this massive empathy then with journalists. If you've kind of grown up in an environment where everybody else was journalists.
I don't know if it's empathy so much as sort of using the right, you know, sort of tone to get, you know,
vocabulary.
Exactly.
Yeah, definitely. Oh, well, excellent. Well, that's fine. My dad worked for a news. He wasn't a journalist. He worked on the kind of print side of things, but he worked in a newspaper for 45 years. I think he was there. So he had to interact with a lot of everybody in the organization, because at the end of the day, it was his team who got the paper out there at the end of the day and got the ink on the paper, when that was how most people consume their news anyway. Look, that has been absolutely fantastic, Megan. Really interesting insight into the world of your world at the FT, but also a fantastic insight, I think, for anyone who is responsible for communicating to groups of people who have requirements that are not typical requirements that we may have to face within organizations. That's been really useful. If people want to reach out to you and connect with you, I've got your LinkedIn profile, which I'll post into the show notes, if that's okay. Any other ways that people can engage with you or reach out to you if they've got any questions or would like to contact you directly?
Yeah, I mean, I do tweet occasionally at Megan Dold, but probably the best way is just to send me an email, which is just megan.dold@ft.com.
Oh, that's very, very kind of you to share that. So I will put that into the show notes, but obviously I'll put your Twitter handle in there as well. So if people want to exchange tweets with you, they can do it that way as well. Well, thank you very much, Megan. It's been brilliant speaking to you. Look after yourself. And hopefully at some point when we're allowed to meet people again, we'll be able to actually have a coffee together and say hello that way as well.
That sounds great. Thank you, Craig.
Take care. Thank you. So thank you for listening to Engaging Internal Comms. Hope you found this episode useful. We'd love to get your feedback and thoughts about the show. So, and also any questions or ideas that you've got for things you'd like us to cover in future episodes. So you can email us at info@thebigpicturepeople.co.uk, or you can get in touch with us via the contact form on our website, which is engagingic.com. Also, you'll be able to sign up for our mailing list there, and we'll send you relevant news about the show, new episodes, and also anything that we think you might be interested in when it comes to internal communications or employee engagement. If you like the show and you haven't already done so, please subscribe to it via your podcast service. And also you can subscribe to it via the links on our podcast page, which again is engagingic.com. If you know anyone else who might be interested in the show, please distribute it to them. Please let them know about it. We want to try and grow a community of people here who are contributing to the show, giving us new ideas for episodes and things that you'd like to cover in future. So thank you very much.